This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin ethics expert makes the case for reinventing patriotism at a time of divided politics. Now, the Republican-controlled Joint Finance Committee passed a budget proposal last week that would cut income taxes across the board to the tune of $3.5 billion in the two-year budget. Democrats say the cuts would disproportionately benefit the wealthiest Wisconsinites over middle and working-class residents. In his original proposal, Governor Evers called for income tax cuts with a focus on middle-class taxpayers. The proposed cuts come at the same time that the Federal Reserve is attempting to lower inflation by cooling the economy with higher interest rates. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you need an income tax cut at the state level? What do you think lawmakers should do with the $7 billion budget surplus? How do you want to see tax cuts, income tax work, if at all? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Logan Kelly is a professor of economics at UW River Falls. He's the university's former Department of Economics chair. Logan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. How are you today?
Pretty good. Well, we've got these dueling income tax cut proposals, one on the table now from Republicans in the legislature. It can get complicated pretty quick, but what do you see, Logan, in the proposal going from four brackets to three, nudging down the rates in those brackets? What kind of impact do you see that having?
Well, generally speaking, I don't see it having a huge amount of impact overall, period. So when we look at tax cuts as a stimulus, as economic stimulus, there's really a mixed bag in terms of historically the different implementations of it. We can go with the 1960s with the Kennedy administration, who actually did do significant amounts of tax cuts and significant amount of tax cuts at the top levels. But at the time, the top marginal tax rate was like 90%. Mm-hmm. Looking at it today, we're not talking about tax rates that are anywhere near that high. Even looking at during the 1980s with the Reagan administration, we were talking coming out of the 70s with much, much higher marginal tax rates, particularly at the top, than what we have now. And so generally speaking, what it strikes me as when we think about tax cuts, a stimulus package today, is a little like it's linear thinking. You know, a little bit of tax cut is good, so a lot of tax cut must be bad.
Comparing the two plans again, Governor Evers said, hey, we're focusing on people making under $100,000 for our income tax cuts. Lawmakers said, no, let's do this for everybody who's paying income tax, including people at the higher levels. When it comes to the impact on an economy, do we know, does targeting one particular group or another seem to make much of a difference when it comes to the economic impact, if any?
Well, when we look at it in terms of theoretically, those in the lower tax brackets are spending, those lower incomes are spending a much greater percentage of their overall income than those at the higher tax brackets, all right? The higher tax brackets, the higher income individuals have more room to save, which is a good thing. But as a result, each one of those dollars going into that higher tax bracket is going to have a lower multiplier effect, you know, speaking strictly theoretically, than those at the lower tax bracket. So in terms of overall which ones it has to, you know, which brackets it's best to target, to be honest, it's kind of questionable, because if we look at it, even if we do target lower tax brackets, a drop in the state income tax doesn't actually amount to a huge, huge amount of additional income or disposable income. Well, for those lower tax brackets, even when we do target those lower tax brackets. One of the things we have to balance that with, especially in a relatively low tax environment such as we are, those services that we have to give up in order to be able to afford those tax cuts.
So the opportunity cost for doing tax cuts, say, versus putting money into another, into some sort of spending in the economy?
Well, sure. So there are basic services that are required for economic growth. And so really, I think this is one of the things I think it's really important to come away with when we think about economic development. It's a multifaceted and complicated process with multiple strategies that we need to approach it with. The economy is a complicated system. And so coming back to the reservoir always, always, always of just cutting taxes isn't necessarily always the right strategy. Sometimes it is, especially when we're in a very, very high tax environment. There are other tools that we can do, and there are other parts to the economy that are important to make sure that exist. Everything from education to basic services being provided through things like broadband internet, through things like making sure roads and bridges are in good order and are up to the level needed for the industry that's there.
Talking to Logan Kelly, professor of economics at UW-River Falls, looking at proposals to cut the income tax in Wisconsin, the economic impact of doing that versus doing other things with our state's budget surplus. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see income tax cuts here in the state? If so, for everybody who pays income tax, for certain groups? If so, which ones? Or are there other better ways to use the state's budget surplus, do you think? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Tom is with us in Rhinelander. Tom, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up, Tom?
I wanted to say that I think that the surplus ought to be spent on municipalities. For over 10 years now, we've had levy limits that have made it very, very hard for counties and other municipalities to hire and retain employees and get their essential jobs done. They've cut to the point where they're bare bones, and I think they need a shot in the arm that some of this money could give to them. If there are to be tax cuts, I would prefer to see them go to the middle class. Over the years since 1980, we've seen the middle class shrink in America, and I think that's a very bad sign for everyone in the long term. And I'd like to finish by quoting Oliver Wendell Holmes, who said, "I like to pay taxes. With them, I buy civilization." Thank you.
Tom, thanks for the call. Okay, a couple main points there. Tom brought out funding for local governments. We have this shared revenue for local governments deal that was reached outside of the budget, putting some of that money that Tom's looking for into local governments. Logan, how do you feel about that as a use of state budget surplus money versus tax cuts?
Well, I think it's a really important point, and I will agree with the Holmes quote. Only I'm going to still say I don't like raising taxes, but I like it better than doing without some of the services that we need, like some of these municipal services that we make available. And it's important because we have many things that happen at the municipal level that benefit the state level. But historically, there hasn't been a good way for revenue to flow back from the state into the municipalities. On top of that, with revenue capping strategies and policies in place, it really has put a lot of institutions, such as municipalities, such as school districts, such as even UW system, in a bind with respect to basically between a rock and a hard place. On one hand, they can't raise revenue. On the other hand, they're getting revenue taken from them in the state budgetary process. So yes, using some of this surplus to support some of the necessary functionality of state government and municipal government, I think would be a really great use for this. Another great use for it might be just to put a little bit of it back in savings for the next recession that's going to happen, when we do need to do some stimulus. If we can do that stimulus out of savings rather than out of borrowing, it becomes much, much more effective.
Our caller also mentioned a concern that the middle class is being squeezed. People are slipping out of it. If that is a policy goal to expand the middle class, is there a tool that you would like to see, say, the state use as opposed to just tax cuts?
Well, the caller makes a really good point in that if we look at the Republican plan so far, as it's currently laid out, the bottom two of the current tax brackets, the maximum tax benefit they would get is somewhere around $250 a year, whereas the top tax bracket, the minimum benefit would be somewhere around $3,500 a year. So there is a little bit of lopsidedness. And of course, with any kind of progressive tax structure, when we have a tax cut, there is going to be that little bit of lopsidedness. But still, there is quite a bit. And so if we're looking at institutions that grow that middle class, and in particular, grow the entire Wisconsin economy, I think we need to take a look at, well, where is it that we need development in the Wisconsin economy? And if we look over the last 10 years or so, I mean, really, it has been within workforce. We've simply had essentially a misalignment of the skills and workers available versus the skills and workers needed by employers. And so I would very much like to see some of this surplus go towards helping retool that workforce and make sure that we have a workforce that's competitive with the rest of the nation.
Thanks again for that call. We're talking to Logan Kelly, professor of economics at UW River Falls, looking at dueling proposals for income tax cuts here in the state, the impact they might have on the state's economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the state cut the level of income taxes? Who in Wisconsin do you think would benefit the most from income tax cuts? Where do you think state resources would be most effective at boosting the economy? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about Republican proposed tax cuts and how they could affect the state economy with Logan Kelly, UW River Falls professor of economics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Talking about income tax here for the most part. Do you want to see income tax cuts? What do you want to know about Wisconsin's economic well-being right now? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Paul is with us in Richland Center. Paul, hi.
Hey, I may be the oddball here, but I do not want a tax cut, and here's why. Give my few bucks that I'm going to get back from this tax cut to the public education system in this state, especially the K-12 system, so our districts don't have to keep floating referendum after referendum to keep their doors open, which ends up raising our taxes anyway. So, and I would, or if, you know, they don't want to do that, then give it to the university system with the drastic cuts that your guest may be out of a job because of that stupid reason of diversity. I am so tired of the Republicans using a tax cut as a bragging point, and meanwhile, our public education system in this entire state is collapsing by the day because they have no money. So give my tax cut to the public education system.
Paul, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Paul, making the case that, you know, cutting income taxes, if we don't put the money into schools, and there was some money put into schools in that shared revenue deal, in effect, the taxes are just shuffled into those local property taxes if referenda are passed, Logan.
Well, indeed. So one of the issues that we run into, and this goes back to also the previous caller talking about helping out municipalities, at some point, basic services have to be provided and have to be paid for. And at the municipal level and at the local K-12 school district level, that could come through levies or come through property taxes. Now, one of the issues with that is that can lead to disproportional provision of education. And so if we have a lower property tax based area, that lower based area is going to have less funding coming into its school system. I think it is a really important point to talk about the need for significant investment in our education system, in that, you know, one of our biggest challenges over the last, and I'll say 10 or 15 years, because that's my kind of time in Wisconsin, but even longer than that, I believe, is the development of workforce and the attraction and retention of talent. And that goes everything from your basic low-skilled worker all the way up to you know, somebody with a PhD or a advanced degree in an area of industry. We need to be able to bring that in. If we have that workforce, then employers will locate here and they will hire people. If employers can't find their workers, they will leave. And so we have essentially an excess demand for labor at most of the realms without the labor throughout the economic spectrum. But that won't last if we don't invest in and develop that workforce. And that includes things like K-12 education, but also post-secondary education, in particular the UW system. We currently are 42nd in the nation in terms of funding higher education.
Thanks for that call. We are looking at proposed income tax cuts here in Wisconsin with Logan Kelly, UW River Falls Professor of Economics. Back to your calls now. John is with us in Algoma. John, hi.
Good afternoon. Wonderful that you're having this discussion. I guess I just wanted to say, actually, as your prior caller just said, I do not want a tax cut. The amount is a pittance, and I, even though I'm retired and on a fixed income, I do not need it. I'm doing fine. But what we need to do is build the infrastructure that develops the state. Wisconsin has developed on the basis of having a world-class educational system, both at the K-12 level, but also at the university level and at the graduate level. Businesses are started because people have an opportunity to see that they can apply their knowledge and develop new processes and new technologies. We need to support that. We also need to support our municipalities and counties and get the roads fixed. By the way, you know, the roads are still horrible. They're improving slowly, but there's a lot more infrastructure development that needs to take place. So let's invest in our children. Let's invest in the future. Let's invest in business by creating the workforce that we need.
John, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Logan, you already talked about that education infrastructure that John was mentioning. He also talked about the physical infrastructure, the things like roads that you touched on briefly earlier. Do you see more room for that kind of investment?
So physical infrastructure can have a hugely stimulative effect on an economy in a couple of different ways. The first way that it does this is in the initial impact of the expenditure of actually building the road, all right, or building the infrastructure. You're hiring people to do that construction. That has an initial impact, but it also has an impact in terms of the efficiency of which we can conduct commerce throughout the state. So being able to access areas is extremely important, and this is part of a road system. That infrastructure, though, goes beyond the physical tangible infrastructure. It's tangible, but stuff that we can see in terms of things like broadband internet. That's absolutely essential for a business to operate in today's day and age. And you need a big pipe to be able to do it, and it has to be reliable, and it needs to be cost effective. And that's something that for large portions of the state, that's still not a reality. And so you just won't see the kind of business development that you would see were that there. So yes, the kinds of infrastructure, both really ultra traditional, let's build some roads and bridges, up through things like provision of utilities like broadband internet, are really important things to invest in.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Ron is with us in Blue Mounds. Ron, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I just want to add to the conversations that have been taking place. For one, please, no more tax cuts. What I'd like to add is that I'm not sure that many Wisconsinites really see the impact of all the tax cuts and the way the budget has been going for the last 10 years. If we take a look across the states, those municipalities and school systems that desperately needed to go to referendum to stay, operating at a decent level, have borrowed somewhere around, the last figure I saw was $11 billion in debt over the last 10 years. And of course, we've watched our state debt cross the $24 billion mark. So a budget is really on projections. We seem fairly confident that we're going to have this surplus, but nothing's guaranteed. So I'm not for spending money that still hasn't been incurred.
Gotcha. Ron, we just have a minute or so left. Logan, your thoughts on Ron's notes on money we've borrowed at the local level and state level?
Well, certainly reduction of debt will reduce our interest expense and help improve surpluses in the future. A certain amount of debt is okay. But of course, another thing we can do with that is retire some of that debt and not incur more by ending up with a larger deficit the next recession that we end up with.
Ron, thanks for that call. Logan, in just our last few moments, what are you watching at most closely when it comes to our state economy and our economic well-being?
Well, right now, the biggest thing on my mind is that yield curve that tends to invert whenever we're expecting a recession in the not-too-distant future. And right now, that pattern's leaking out that we could be looking at recessionary times end of the year versus beginning of next year, hopefully not too severe a recession. But it's important to keep that in mind as we're thinking about tax policies that expansion, this may be premature for an expansionary policy.
Logan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Logan Kelly, professor of economics at UW River Falls. He joined us for a look at calls for income tax cuts here in the state. The Joint Finance Committee in the legislature advanced an income tax cut plan. It would have to go to the full legislature, then to the governor as part of the two-year state budget process. You can keep sharing your thoughts on the idea of income tax cuts. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. If you have thoughts on what the state should or shouldn't do with its budget surplus, let us know about it. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, less efficient light bulbs are being phased out of the market. Find out why and check out the options for lighting your home. And join in with your own questions or what you've done when it comes to replacing those incandescent light bulbs of what will soon be the past. Let us know and then join that conversation tomorrow morning at 8. That's here on the Ideas Network. Here in the U.S., people spend a lot of money, time, and effort trying to look and feel younger. But in South Korea, they found another way. Everybody in the country is about to get a year or two younger by law. As reported by the Wall Street Journal, South Korea is about to change the official way they count people's ages. Right now, the moment you're born, you're counted as one. And ages go up when the new year hits. So if you're born on New Year's Eve, you start off at one. And tomorrow, New Year's Day, you're two. Under a new law, South Koreans will move to the international system, which we use, where you're 0 years old when you start off, and you go up on your birthday, not with the new year. South Koreans quoted in the Wall Street Journal have mixed feelings about the change. Some worry about confusion. Some are unhappy. They already turned 50 once. Now they got to do it again. One woman says she's happy she'll have a couple extra years to meet her parents' goal, that she gets married by her mid-30s. Those new standards kick in tomorrow. I say you're as old as you feel. For me, sometimes that's 13. Sometimes it's 200. It all evens out. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, new reporting says more than 122,000 people are held daily in solitary confinement in U.S. prisons and jails. Find out why its use has become so widespread and why some states are trying something new. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, long-term polling finds that the number of Americans who view patriotism as being very important has dropped a lot over the last 30 years. That's according to a series of surveys from the Wall Street Journal and the pollsters at NORC. And younger people are less likely than previous generations to describe themselves as patriotic. Our next guest says a big factor in that change is a big problem, people putting their partisan goals ahead of the country as a whole. With July 4th, just a week off, we want to hear your thoughts on patriotism. Join in now at 800-642-1234. What does patriotism mean to you? Do you consider yourself patriotic? Do you see people putting political party before national interest? If so, what could we do to fix that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rick Kite is director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse and co-host of the Ethical Life podcast. He wrote a piece about patriotism for the Wisconsin State Journal. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Good to be here.
Now, patriotism might mean different things to different people. Let's get a working definition. What are we talking about when we talk about patriotism?
I tend to think that patriotism is a conviction that we are all bound together and that we're bound together with a national identity. And it is also not just a recognition of that fact, but a celebration of it. Like, this is a good thing that we are bound together in different kinds of groups and national identity of one of them. So patriotism is like love of family, love of community. We've also got love of country. So it's one of the many ways in which we celebrate the kind of social identity that we have as human beings.
I mentioned that Wall Street Journal polling that you reference in your piece that I mentioned, upwards of 70% of Americans said, hey, yeah, patriotism, very important, back in 1990. That's dropped to the 30-some percent. You know, a lot of people still say it's pretty important. What do you make of that drop?
Well, I make of it is we are not as bound together at the local level. And then for that reason, when we think about national politics, we are thinking mostly about terms in terms of our friends and our enemies, and not thinking of ourselves as having a national identity, but having national interests that are essentially in competition. And I think that's a dangerous trend. And I think of people like my great uncle, who had fought in World War I and who had made a point to visit, I think, every president after FDR, something like that, when they would come through towns on trains to give the speeches, whether they're Democrat or Republican, because he just thought that was important for him to understand his responsibilities as a citizen. And so I think we have less appreciation for our responsibilities as citizens and kind of more attention to what we demand from the nation.
The core, I think, of your piece is this idea that you were starting to touch on, that we're starting to put our partisan identity and our partisan policy preferences ahead of that idea of shared identity. How did we get there? What do you think is driving that?
Well, I think it's lack of participation at the local level. And we have all this data now on, like, each generation has fewer friends, fewer social interactions than the generation before. And that loss of social connection pretty much tracks with the decline in patriotism. And the way I think they're connected is when you have a lot of social connections at the local level, you regularly interact with people who disagree with you, but you find out they're not really that bad of people. You just disagree about some things. And so then you make the assumption nationally, well, most people are like that. I might disagree with them, but they're not really bad people. But when you don't have those kinds of diverse social connections at the local level, you start to think that the people who disagree with you actually are really bad people. And it's hard then to think of oneself as having a shared identity with them.
Talking to Rick Kite with Viterbo University in La Crosse, looking at what it means to be patriotic, why there's been a decline in the number of people who say patriotism is very important to them in polling here in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does patriotism mean to you? Do you consider yourself patriotic? What would it take to bridge some of the partisan divides over big issues and over identity in the United States? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rick, before we go to our callers, I want to quote from your piece in the State Journal here. We will never come to widespread agreement about many of the goals we seek for our nation. The best we can do is come to agreement about the means by which we pursue those goals. So I think that's super interesting, the idea of respecting the system and the process, even when we don't get the outcome we want. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, when you look at something like the Constitution, it sets forth kind of like what, as Americans, we consider to be broad goals, but then it specifies pretty precisely, you know, what the means are, what are the rules we have to follow? Because of course we aren't going to all agree on all of the issues, all of the goals that we have. And so this understanding of like, well, how does government work? What are its limitations? What are the responsibilities of citizenship? These are all about process. They're all about means. And that's where we shape our kind of national unity. And and especially, I mean, you can kind of do these kinds of calculations when you find out that we have such closely contested elections, and the number of things that people have opinions on that they would like to see made either legal or illegal. It turns out that the majority of people are frustrated in their wishes the majority of the time. And so you can have the expectation, I'll be happy once I get the majority of the things that I want, you know, as a partisan player. That's simply not going to happen. You have to say, okay, I'm going to be satisfied if at least we're all following the rules. And I think there's a path forward with that. I just don't think we're paying enough attention to it.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Julia is with us in Madison. Julia, hi.
Hi. I am, just to be upfront, a white middle-class American who was raised very much appreciating patriotism and small-town, rural, growing up in parades, to honor veterans. And what I've come to see that the word patriotism has evolved into something that is an ideology that is different than it used to be, and I don't agree with. Patriotism was an African American in the right before the World War II, standing on a track and field athlete, standing up and holding up his hand to be proud to be an American. And what we've done to quarterback Kaepernick is atrocious to me. He respectfully used his power, his position, to try to draw attention to something that he feels is important, and now he can't even do his job as an athlete. And I see him as a role model. I see him as someone that I would want my African-American children and everybody to look up to, because he used his position for speaking to something that was unfair. We've been based on slavery way too long, and we've never apologized, and even Germany has done that for its atrocities. And so,
Julia, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Rick, your thoughts on Julia's views on our changes in what we think about patriotism?
Yeah, I think unfortunately that the word patriotism itself has become a partisan marker. And especially for many people who identify more as liberal or progressive, they kind of cringe at the word because it seems to be kind of owned by the right wing. I think that's unfortunate. I think it needs to be reclaimed by all Americans. I don't like this tendency of one party wanting to claim kind of the patriotic label, because then it becomes identified more with partisan goals rather than the process by which we shape our lives together. I have mixed feelings about the Colin Kaepernick protest. I agree that he was really shabbily treated. I think it was unwise for him to choose to protest against the national anthem, perfectly within his rights. And we need to respect that. I mean, this is part of patriotism too, is respect people that don't agree with our national symbols. And it's certainly something that draws a great deal of attention, of course, which is why he did it. But I also think it's unfortunate. I think that's not a way that you, if you really want to bring attention to a widespread problem that the only way it's going to get addressed is by addressing it together. You don't do it by making the national symbol itself the means of protest.
Julia, thanks for the call. Rick Kite stays with us from Viterbo University in La Crosse. We're looking at patriotism in divided times, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. When you think about people you disagree with politically, do you think there's common ground that you can agree on, meet on amid the debates? What does patriotism mean to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk about patriotism and the partisan divide with Rick Kite, director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse, co-host of the Ethical Life podcast. His piece from the Wisconsin State Journal on this topic is linked at WPR.org/Central Time. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jason is with us in Madison. Jason, hi.
Hi, Rob. I called in because I've never actually considered myself all that much of a patriot until recently, when I find the system of American democracy is under attack, and suddenly I find myself compelled to defend it.
And do you think you've taken action, Jason? What kind of things have you done with this newfound idea of patriotism?
To be honest, I don't think I've done enough. I've proceeded with my civic duties as I have before, just a newfound sense of purpose and trying to convince the people I talk to that maybe they should find that purpose too.
Gotcha. Jason, thanks a lot for the call. Rick, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. I really think it's important to reclaim the idea of patriotism. I think it's, and I think it's important to emphasize that it is not a matter of taking sides in the political debates. It's a matter of finding common ground, finding unity with our citizens so that we can work together to make life better for all of us. And I don't think that's a partisan issue. I think that's something most Americans would say, yeah, I agree with that. We should make life better. And we have to have some understanding of, like, we have a shared commitment in this project, and we want things to be better for the next generation. And so how do we do it? And so congratulations. That's great that you're considering yourself a patriot, because we need people that are part of this effort to reclaim the very idea.
Thanks for the call. Richard joins us now in Two Rivers. Richard, hi.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for having me on the air. My question is kind of simple but complicated. It's why and when did we have such a disrespect for our presidents? I mean, I've never seen it more than flying two flags off the back of your pickup truck than I've seen now, and there's no discussion about it. Well, why and when did it happen?
Richard, thanks for the call. Rick, do you think we've gotten more willing to express our dissatisfaction, maybe even in vulgar terms, against our presidents? If so, why?
I'm not sure about that. When you go back in history, mm-hmm. you find a lot of contempt for various presidents. And we've had some real bad presidents. and you know, some presidents are fairly good at kind of unifying the nation, usually in times of some kind of national crisis, but I think what we've really lost is respect for the institution and the ability to distinguish the office from the individual, and that's part of the reason for that. I think is the gradual growth of executive power over the years, so that, you know, like, most people really think that the president acts pretty much like a king and implements whatever kind of policies they want. And when you hear during the campaign time of the presidential candidates, you hear people talking about what will happen if their opponent gets elected, and they really seem to think they have pretty much unfettered power. And that's a problem, because the higher the stakes are, the higher the more the rhetoric ramps up, and the more the emotion ramps up, and so part of toning down that public contempt for the person who holds office is understanding the limitations on their power. And I think also working harder to restore the power that should be held by both Congress and the courts.
Thanks for that call. And that seems like a danger here, Rick, if individuals are putting their party identity, their partisan goals first. It seems like there's often a lot of at least very vocal pressure on a president, on our guy, whichever side you're on our guy to push the rules, bend the rules, take more power in order to accomplish what I want them to do and forget those institutional checks and balances that are there for a reason. Is that a worry for you?
That's a really significant worry. And I make the claim in the column that most people right now function as short-term consequentialists. And that is that they're focused on immediate results, and they tend to think that an action is right if it has good results. And that's not what, like, when I teach ethics, that's not the main part of ethics that I'm teaching. Ethics is mostly about the various kinds of constraints we place on ourselves and upon one another based on the certain types of actions. So we say, like, you shouldn't cheat, you shouldn't lie, you shouldn't steal. Not because those some things might not sometimes get you some good results. It's because of the type of action. And so we have to have more understanding in our nation of a kind of an allegiance, a commitment to the process of and so that's why that worries me. This, like, this pressure we have, I think, on our politicians to just get us the results we want, no matter how they do it.
I want to spend our last few minutes looking at possible solutions, Rick. And one thing you really are making the case for in your piece and here on the air is for people to get involved at the local level in politics. One hurdle there is, you know, you have to go to a place and it takes time to get involved. It can be a little boring to sit through public meetings sometimes versus the quick fix of, I'm going to make an angry comment on social media and that's my political participation. How do we get people to overcome that that convenience problem of involvement?
Yeah, it can be really boring, especially if one is only a casual participant. And so, like, the more you get involved, the more interesting it becomes, because you begin to know the players more, you form kind of relationships with them, and you understand the process and what's actually going on. But the first step is a really simple one. It's simply joining social groups, joining social organizations, and making a commitment to make it a part of your life. And what we've seen in America is a real growth in private life and a diminishment of social life. And so I don't think there's any way to recover patriotism without restoring a kind of robust social life. And that's where we start.
And then you've talked a lot today about, you know, seeing that political opponent as a fellow American, as not an enemy, but as, you know, maybe an adversary on these particular debates. I've had a lot of conversations on this show with people who try to bring together people from different points of view. Where do you see opportunities? Where do you see ways that we can get people from different backgrounds, different partisan views to embrace that shared American identity?
We begin by loving our neighbor. We begin by loving our actual neighbor, whether we like them or not. And then we extend it to our metaphorical neighbor, the person that maybe we see across the state or across the country. So that becomes a habit. But it starts really close to home.
And then where do we take it from there? We often now separate ourselves geographically, so we're more likely to agree with that neighbor. How do we move to that next step?
Move to the next step by working as hard as we can to sympathetically understand people. And the more we understand people's lives, the harder it is to hate them. And that goes to everybody. It goes, you know, to our real neighbor, but it also goes to the politician. And so try not to see people who represent us, say, at the state level or the national level, just as these one or two dimensional figures, but as real human beings, get to know something of their story.
Briefly, Rick, are you optimistic that we can do these things?
Yeah, I am. And I'm optimistic because I see within young people, I see a real desire for community. think there's a lot of headwinds against them, but there's a real desire for community, and I think that's where our hope lies.
Rick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Rick Kite, director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse, co-host of the Ethical Life podcast. We've got a link to his piece on patriotism and appeared in the Wisconsin State Journal. Find that link at WPR.org/Central Time and keep sharing your thoughts on the meaning of patriotism. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. saw increased attention to public health efforts at the beginning of COVID, but less attention now. An epidemiologist joins the show to say that that's a common cycle of panic and neglect, and it leaves us less prepared for the next disease outbreak. Plus, we'll look at higher rates of depression here in the United States, some of the causes and some possible solutions. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, Wisconsin ranks last in the nation in per capita state funding for the arts. We'll learn more about efforts to increase that funding and what challenges the current levels create. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.